Thanks for having me. I'm here in our Biblical Counseling Center in DuPage County in Winfield, Illinois, and it's a pleasure to be with you guys and just be able to talk through a crucial issue if you're going to be in biblical counseling that you have to learn how to handle and handle wisely. And it's just so crucial that, that we take the topic of suicide seriously, just because the results are catastrophic when we don't. And but it's a tricky topic for sure, and it's one that our counselors have to deal with. And so I hope to give some practical advice tonight. I also hope to give some theological understanding of how we might engage the heart of a person who's considering suicide or has attempted suicide. We're not going to get into caring for those whose loved one has committed suicide. That would be beyond the scope of what we can handle tonight. That's a whole different topic. Even this morning, I got an email from a young mom who is struggling after her husband took his life. And she's a young mom with three kids. And just asking, you know, is there any way somebody can talk to me? I need help. Yet I also feel the burden of was the church there? Was the church there for her husband in the way that, you know, she needed him to be? And could they have engaged in a wiser way what, you know, what he was going through? And so I think we're all touched by suicide in some respects. And almost everyone knows somebody who has attempted suicide, or they even know somebody who has taken their life. And it's just crucial that we kind of get that right. So we're going to talk through some of the practical nuts and bolts of it first, and then we're going to talk through a plan to engage a suicidal person wisely, and then we'll have time for Q&A at the end. So if you got your handout, go to the handout that you have, Suicide Prevention and Gospel Care. Suicide Prevention and Gospel Care. And I think it should go without saying that preventing suicide would be close and dear to the heart of God, that if we're going to be pro-life, we need to be pro-life in areas of advocating for those who are tempted to take their own life, and that's you know, certainly what you face when you have somebody who's suicidal. And so there's alarming statistics coming out right now on suicide. And since 2000, we've seen a 28% increase in suicide. And in 2016, nearly 45,000 Americans aged 10 or older died by suicide. And that's now the 10th leading cause of death in America. And we've just seen that the rates continue to increase. You can see some of it on the last bullet point there. That's the third leading cause of death for children 10 to 14 years of age, second leading cause of death for 15 to through 24. And so we're seeing the prevalence of suicide in the teenage years and in the college years, and it's tragically a life that's wasted. And so what we want to do is to kind of walk through some of the risk factors and through some of the prevention strategies. And and in your email, you're going to be getting some links to some of the fuller prevention strategies and some of these documents that can be helpful in your church thinking through, and you as a counselor thinking through, how are we going to best respond to suicide. I remember last year getting the call that a young man that I had known, who was now a young adult, tragically chose to take his life. And it kind of haunts you a little bit, because you wonder why didn't they call? Like, why didn't they reach out? And you know, what were the warning signs there, and should I have seen them? And I remember too when I was 7 years old, and the phone rang during one of my birthday parties, and my dad, who was a counselor at this point, just as a youth pastor, not in any formal sense, but he had been working with a young man who chose to take his life. And some people have often asked the question, how did my parents, who were youth workers, become biblical counselors? And it largely was that day, and the pain of that day propelled my dad to go to Penn State and then on to Westminster Seminary to get training in how to better care for families and the hurting that were around him. And it was a year where he kind of did a lot of introspection and a lot of wondering, should I have seen the warning signs? And so there's been a lot of research that's been done since then on the warning signs. And so part of what we want to work through tonight is how do we approach those who are contemplating suicide? When I first started counseling and became the director of the counseling center 7 years ago, it never dawned on me as I was meeting with pastors that pastors could be suicidal. And as I've had the privilege of meeting with many pastors, and I meet with many pastors over the course of a year, even pastors and those in ministry face temptations for suicide. And I had never gotten to that point as a pastor where I felt like, you know, suicide was the best path forward. Yet I recognize there's unique pressures even for those in ministry. And so one of the goals for tonight is to open your eyes to some of the risk factors. And then also, I want to encourage you to take the risk to have uncomfortable conversations. If anything, one of the things that you've got to grasp about this whole issue of suicide is that when you see the risk factors, you need to speak up. When you see the when you see the warning signs, you need to speak up. People who are suicidal will typically tell you if they are. Most people don't keep it hidden. Yet they may not come right out and just say, well, this is where I'm at. And so the goal is to engage them in a conversation, say, you know what, it sounds to me like this is what you're thinking. Am I seeing this right? And so turn a page to your handout, and you can see some of the risk factors that researchers have identified as risk factors for suicide. And so, again, you're going to see previous suicide attempts. Obviously, that goes without saying. Like, if they've been suicidal once, they can easily go there again. But substance abuse and losing a friend to suicide, it's interesting that less than half of people who commit suicide have been diagnosed with a mental health condition. Sometimes we think that they obviously, you know, lost their mind and they went crazy, yet less than half have been identified with a mental health condition. And so you can see some of the risk factors that are there. Now, some of the warning signs. What are some of the things that you might hear and see from people? You know, you see alcohol and drug misuse and people flirting with a line and blackout type behavior. Sometimes you see in the bottom right there, you see dramatic changes in mood and behavior. I mean, they might get all of a sudden almost silly with many important aspects of life. They may, if you see kind of up the page on the right there, aggressiveness and irritability. So they may be getting increasingly agitated as they're thinking about suicide. People who attempt suicide generally think about it for quite some time before they ever seem to want to attempt it. I remember sitting with a young pastor, and he kept answering the question, if I have to live past Friday, here's what I would do. But he's like, I don't want to live past Friday. And we were sitting here on Wednesday, and obviously it was a tense situation as we were talking through some of the situations in life. And he's like, I just don't want to live anymore. Like, I want to be done. And you wouldn't think that people in ministry would get to that point, yet the reality is that they do. Yet others with an issue with, substance abuse, and this young youth pastor actually had an issue with substance abuse, which certainly complicated his ministry and had sent him into hiding and social isolation and feeling alone. And he had been, just contemplating, how do I get out of this mess that I've created of my life, the situation where I feel worthless, I feel like I'm a hypocrite, and I don't want to have to, go through this any longer. And so, again, you see some of the warning signs there. And it's important that you as a counselor, you begin to listen for these things and to help people work through them. So we're not going to go through all those, but go ahead and, take a look at that and familiarize yourself with that. The next page is, some of the this is from the Centers for Disease Control, but how do we think through some of the strategies to help prevent suicide? And again, this is totally from a secular point of view. This is not from a perspective that prioritizes faith. But we as biblical counselors, of course, are going to come from a different perspective in that we feel like the secular perspectives are going to be incomplete. They're not going to prioritize faith in the same way that we are. They're not going to view suffering in the same way that we do. Look at some of the suicide prevention strategies. They're challenging people to strengthen economic supports. Now, why is that? You often see a correlation between homelessness and suicide. You see a correlation between job loss and suicide, some of the homicidal suicide scenarios where you see play out in the workplace happens when people are fired from their job. You also see men whose identity was wrapped up in their work who will take their life when their economic financial security is threatened. Also, it's interesting to note that you'll see there's a growing trend within the research on suicide to see rural areas seem to be growing the fastest in suicide rates. And part of that is there's not access to counseling and mental health care at all in rural areas oftentimes. Certainly, oftentimes not more than once a month, perhaps at a county health department, but this is not going to be adequate to help someone who's really suicidal working through these types of issues. And what a beautiful opportunity for the church, though, isn't it? Because there's churches in rural areas all over the place. There's churches that can be the places where people can turn to in the midst of their crisis. And churches can be known as a place where suicide can be talked about and where it can be engaged and where people can be accepted and they can get some accountability and also some hope for some of the underlying issues that are causing struggles. Then strengthening access and delivery of suicide care. I would just challenge those churches that are in rural areas to take the challenge to say, we're going to be part of the solution. I don't expect there's going to be a lot of psychologists moving into rural Wisconsin or rural Idaho in setting up shop. The reality is the church is already there. And the more that churches, gospel-centered churches, can be sources of hope, it can be important. So you can see some of the other kind of strategies there. And again, I mean, some of that is psychological, strategies that certainly, are going to be incomplete at best. But there's some good thoughts there on how to best, how a church might be able to respond to some of the factors that would increase the tendencies towards suicide in the heart and in the lives of their people. And I remember this past summer I was asked to speak at a church that they were beginning AWANA registration. They were beginning AWANA registration minus their AWANA commander who had, after 25 years as AWANA commander, taken his life. And you can imagine that as a church, they're reeling from the fact that they have to now give an answer to kids and give an answer to families. And they really were like, we're really not quite sure what to say. Not sure how to engage this conversation beyond, he shouldn't have done this. But, we started beginning a conversation in this church about how we can best have the kind of conversations, how you can create a church where people can open up and reach out for help. And one of the things that, what was just interesting about the church is it's kind of a conservative church, and it's a church where, they haven't had a lot of these interpersonal conversations. And it just struck me that somebody from 25 years, very few people saw any real warning signs. And he hadn't really had conversations with people about the kind of struggles that he was going through. And I think we need to be more aware to get these issues out on the table and begin to talk through why does suicide take place? And what do we do when we get to the point where our heart's in a point of despair? And so I want to transition a little bit now to, biblical counseling viewpoint and how do we view the complicated interaction between our bodies and our minds and our feelings. And, part of why this is important is to realize this, that when you hear the media and other places talk after a celebrity commits suicide, they often talk about suicide as something that just happens. Their brain broke. Remember this past summer when Anthony Bourdain, the CNN news personality and chef, took his life. His friends were going on and they were basically eulogizing him on CNN and talking about some of the struggles that he faced. Yet one of the things that was coming up is that, you know, his brain just broke. And it's not a helpful way to talk about suicide, because actually, I would argue that it actually increases the suicide rate. And you see this after, celebrities commit suicide. So after, Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade committed suicide, they saw an increase in suicide rate over the next month or two that they think directly correlated to the fact that two famous personalities took their life. The same statistical variation was noted after Robin Williams took his life. And so what they see is that after certain celebrities and certain people of prominence, and when it's in the news cycle repeatedly, people will often conclude, if even a celebrity can't make it through this, then I'm not sure I can make it through this. And so, but from a biblical counseling viewpoint, we're going to anchor our understanding and our viewpoint in the fact that God created us for a purpose, and that the body and the mind and the feelings and thinking, our behavior, thought, and emotion patterns all interact with each other. And so you can see this in kind of the chart here, the body-heart interaction, but there's another actor, and that actor is God. And so the reality is that the hope that we have in the midst of dealing with a person who's struggling with suicide is that we have a hope that there's a point to the pain, that there's a point to the struggle, that there is the ability to trust God in the midst of the storm, and to be able to turn to Him. And we anchor our counsel in that. Now, the reality is that you believe that more than the suicidal person that you're dealing with. You believe that more than they do. And so they're not in a position to typically wholeheartedly embrace that. Yet you're pleading with them, and you're patiently talking with them about the hope that they can have in the midst of the storm. And so we recognize the body and emotions as factors that need to be addressed. And so is there some truth to the fact that somebody's brain breaks before suicide? Well, there are some, biological considerations and some depression and other things that certainly are physical. Yet it's going to be incomplete to say that somebody's brain just broke makes suicide sound as if it's inevitable. If your brain breaks, it's just a matter of time before you commit suicide too. And it sounds compassionate to say it on the news and to say to the family, you know what, they wouldn't have chosen this. Yet we need to have a more nuanced conversation than that, because they did choose that. And they did have some choice in the matter. And we don't limit our counsel to spiritual advice. We recognize that all dimensions of man must be dealt with. I remember one of the first cases that I had as a counselor. I was dealing with 11 and 12-year-old boys whose father had taken his life. And I remember being assigned this case and not quite wondering what to say. And or not knowing what to say. I was wondering what to say. And I didn't know how to approach it. And the boys just had an understanding that, dad wasn't suffering anymore. He wasn't in pain anymore. And he had been depressed, and he had been unemployed, and there were some substance issues and other things. One of the things as I wrestled through, that was, how do you explain suicide, and how do you explain it in a way that is compassionate, yet also recognizes that if these boys don't come to understand that there was some choice there, there tends to be a cyclical pattern within suicide. There tends to be a pattern of, hurt that begets hurt within families. And they need to understand that their dad did love them, but he also chose wrongly, because there was a path out of the pain. There was a point of escape. And I didn't want these young men to live with the understanding that the suicide is just inevitable if you get depressed, which was what seemed to be, the message coming from some around, trying to be compassionate to them, but not giving them quite the right message. So here's what we have to realize. and I've just come to realize in dealing with those who are struggling with depression, is that, you know, everyone dealing with depression has a story. They have a background. The first part of their story is not the choice to figure out a means to end their life. They don't go from life is going great to tomorrow I choose suicide. And, so there's a downward spiral. And if you go to the next page, you're going to see a chart that we use oftentimes dealing with depression, but it also works within conversations about suicide. And the way I would say it is this, that suicide begins with disappointment. Like the part of the story is that there's disappointment in life, that there is sadness regarding the circumstances of one's life. And it tends to be, this perpetual disappointment. And we have conflict because we don't get what we want. We have disappointment because we don't get what we want. The idols of our heart don't ultimately come to a point where they satisfy. And so we have disappointment that ultimately is borne out in, you can see this, within our ruling desires. And so within our ruling desires, those are the things that make us tick. Those are the things that are important to us. And whether that be money, whether that be power, whether that be substances, whether that be sex, whether that be relationships, whether that be family, whether that be religious experiences, these ruling desires are what we the things that we are ultimately serving, the things that we think about the most, the things that wake us up in the morning. And there's disappointment. Now, when disappointment becomes entrenched, it leads to a state of discontentment, right? Where it's just, this is dispositional, discontent. And so it's just the way that you are. And people begin to see that you have an edge, and there's brooding, and there's anger, and there's bitterness, self-pity, self-righteousness. This is somebody who has a perpetually critical and negative spirit and a negative attitude. And so a disappointment, when we live with it, when we don't deal with it, when we don't take our disappointments to God and allow His answers to our disappointments, it ultimately breeds discontentment. And when we live in discontentment for too long, ultimately it leads to despair or hopelessness, seeing no way out, giving up on responsibilities. And so the reality is this, that people who are suicidal are living typically in a state of despair. That's where they're living their life. They're past the point of just disappointment and discontent. Despair is just this hopelessness that there's no point. Like, it really can't get better. What's the use of trying? And, so they are blinded in some senses to any of the possibilities. So this could be somebody who's in a really difficult marriage. This could be somebody who's, dealing with a, diagnosis that may be even life-threatening. I remember a young man who was connected to our church somehow, found out, 28 years old, he found out that he had cancer. And, he had seen what cancer did to some of his friends as they went through chemotherapy, and he went out in the field and he took his life. And but it was just despair. And he's like, I'm not going to fight cancer. I'm not going to deal with this. Like, I don't want to have to go through the fight of cancer. And so it came on pretty quickly, but seeing no way out, is giving up on responsibilities. And ultimately, where does it end to? It gets to destructiveness. And this is, where it can become suicidal or homicidal. But the reality is destructive behavior also can be substance abuse. It can be people who commit adultery. You oftentimes see that there's a destructive behavior and it's like, I don't care anymore. I'm willing to tank my marriage for some excitement. It can be, destructiveness might be people who will quit their job or they will engage in very reckless behavior. I remember a young woman leaving her office and she was in a suicidal, was in a suicidal thought process. And, she was leaving and we're right along a 4-lane road and she pulled out, and gunned it just right in front of traffic and cars slammed to the brakes and honking their horns and she just peeled out of there and come to find out from her husband, she was also driving nearly 100 miles per hour, you know, on the way home. And it was just like she was furious that, you know, he would not break off his adultery. And, you know, it gotten her to the point where it's just like, I don't care if I live or if I die. You hear statements of people. It's like, I just hope I don't wake up tomorrow morning. And I know when I've been dealing with pastors, oftentimes I hear that, you know, they will pray as they're in their bed at night. I mean, God, take my life so that I don't have to continue any longer. And, you know, that's where that destructiveness even comes in. They may not be taking active steps, but they're at that point. And so how do we address the downward cycle of depression? And so not every suicidal person would say that they're dealing with depression. It need to be really clear on this, that 50% of the people who commit suicide didn't have discernible warning signs, that people were kind of in the dark. Yet you do find with many who do commit suicide that you're going to see kind of this, you know, this cycle kind of play itself out. And so, you know, how do we do that? Just giving a quick overview, and I'm not going to go through every verse here. You can kind of look them up on your own. But we address disappointment by offering the biblical perspective that leads to acceptance of God's providence, that there's a point to your pain. It's a point to what you're going through, that God's going to use it for good in your life. You address ruling desires by evaluating them and submitting them to the will of God as revealed in Scripture. This stops the downward progression of the slippery slope. And so it is what you want, is the idols of your heart really going to satisfy? And addressing discontentment by urging conviction that prompts repentance. And, you know, so again, challenging people to find hope and addressing despair by urging perseverance prompted by hope, and then ultimately addressing destructiveness by developing a plan for help. And so when people are at a destructive point, they need people to come alongside them. They don't see the path forward clearly. And so you need to make sure that you help them to evaluate and see clearly the destructive choices that they're making. And so, again, you can look through some of the verses there and understand that. But in order to be helpful with many people who are suicidal in the conversations that you're going to have, there's going to be strong correlation between those who would say they're depressed and have gone through the, you know, the cycles of spiritually rooted depression. Now, reality is they have physical complications going along with the spiritually rooted depressions as well. Sometimes medicines are able to help those who are suicidal to slow down their thought processes and to be able to get out of a loop of negative thinking. Ultimately, medicine can't change people's thinking. Medicine can't cure people's thinking. Medicine can't give people hope. And so it's going to just be one part of the solution. What gives people hope the most is love. What gives people hope the most is friendship. What gives people most hope the most is support and turning them back to God as the answer for their pain. And so I just challenge people who are dealing with those who are suicidal to underestimate the importance of a relationship. Don't underestimate the importance of just saying, you know, I'll be there for you. You can call me at any point of the night. I was talking with a friend today who was recently encountering someone who was suicidal within his small group. And, you know, that after the small group, the guy made a comment about wanting to you know, get hit by a bus on the way home. I hope I get hit by a bus on the way home tonight. And, you know, so he chose to engage. He chose to engage and say, you know what, do I need to go to your house? He knew the guy was a hunter. He had guns in the house. He's like, do I need to drive you home tonight? Do you need to come stay with me? Like, do you know that we can talk this through? And the reality is that, you know, he was able to talk through with his friend and, you know, offer him support. And they were able to get together in a few days and kind of talk it through. And he did a great job of just engaging in a friendly way. Now, he was asking me if he did the right thing. And I'm like, absolutely, he did the right thing. He did the right thing by being the kind of friend who would engage the difficult conversation and say, you know what, this might be awkward, but I need to know. I need to know if you are thinking in suicidal ways. Because if you are, it's like, I want you to know that I'm going to be here for you, that I'm going to be able to be the one who's going to help you. And you know what, we can get you help in many different ways and to begin to think through the assets that are available to bring help to this person. So what I want to do next is I want to go through an article that I wrote, and it's a plan to engage a suicidal person wisely. And so that's your second handout there. So you want to go ahead and grab that out. PLAN is an acronym. And oftentimes, as I'm teaching and training in churches, they ask me to train on crisis situations and how to help elders and others deal with crisis. And suicide is certainly one of these. And PLAN is an acronym that I use in dealing with crisis situations. How do we deal with those situations? Certainly, suicide is one of the most crucial crisis situations that you can engage in. And so, how do we develop a plan? How do you develop a plan to engage a suicidal person wisely? And this starts out here where it says, if someone trusts you enough to reach out for help, or you pick up on something that concerns you, makes you wonder if another person has intentions of suicide, what do you do next? It feels like a great weight of responsibility, and it is. So we use a simple acrostic when training churches on how to engage those with suicidal intentions or thoughts. Having a plan to deal with your suicidal intentions or thoughts saves lives and organizes your efforts. So the P in plan is pursue. Pursue. One of the things that you have to recognize, and one of the things that you just have to take on the burden, if you're going to take on the burden of being a biblical counselor, is you've got to be willing to pursue people even in awkward conversations. You got to be willing to pursue that extra conversation, to ask the follow-up conversation, a follow-up question, to engage in the conversation, because God calls us to that. That's part of what we're training to do. That's part of what we're committing to do, is saying, I'm going to find out when I see a warning sign if there's something more behind that. Like, I'm going to find out if the warning sign is related to suicidal thinking. Not everyone who struggles with substance abuse is going to struggle with suicidal thoughts. Yet when you see a marked change in substance abuse, you may ask the question, why is this change occurring at this point? And so if you see something, say something. Suicide is generally contemplated over time, and there are warning signs. And so some individuals struggling with suicidal thinking are quite open about it, but others keep it mostly hidden from warning signs. And so what does a biblical pursuit recognize about God's heart regarding suicide? The first issue is this, is that we are image bearers of God. So we believe, we're pro-life. We believe in the importance of life. We believe life is worth going after, and that people are not beyond the redemption of Christ, that we are to honor the temple of the Holy Spirit, that suicide matters. Suicide is wrong. It doesn't condemn someone to hell. But it does dishonor God, and dishonors the purpose for which God made us. And so we're to honor the temple of the Holy Spirit. Murder is condemned, right? And so we recognize that, self-murder, which is suicide, is not something that pleases the Lord. And ultimately, recognize that God is sovereign over all of life and can be trusted. You see this in Job. But also recognize the last bullet point here is this, is that no human being can prevent suicide. Is the free will of man to make such a choice. You cannot take upon the burden to say, I will prevent all suicide. Because there's no way you can guarantee that. If you set yourself up for that, you set yourself up for disappointment as a counselor. But you can have a position where you wisely engage suicide, where you are willing to get a team of people around somebody who is suicidal and to give them support in a wise way. You can help them to have hope that they're going to be able to get through the struggle that they're facing. And so no human being can prevent it all. Second to last bullet point there, just to reiterate, suicidal intent is not the unforgivable sin, nor does it send someone directly to hell. I remember multiple times I've had people question that. And so they wonder, will I go directly to hell if I commit suicide? That's kind of a tricky question to answer as a counselor, right? Am I going to go to hell if I commit suicide? How would you answer that question? Think about that right now. You have to answer that question wisely. And, oftentimes they've heard from people, yes, you'll go to hell, because people have told them that because they think it's the best way to prevent suicide. If the reality is that it tends to create fear and anger towards the Lord, and that doesn't bring about kindness. That doesn't bring about repentance and faith. And so it actually is counterproductive to tell people things that aren't true. Ultimately, I want them to want to live because God has a purpose for their life, not because it's just going to prevent them from going to hell. Because at some point, some suicidal people are dealing with shame to such a degree that they feel like they deserve hell. I deserve hell for what I've done. You think about people who commit suicide after they're found out for a criminal event. A youth pastor in our area, after he had been found out for child sexual abuse, went to a hotel in Wisconsin and he took his life. Yeah, you hear about these kind of stories where another man in our town killed somebody in a DUI kind of accident. Then he and his girlfriend took their life in suicide rather than facing the consequences in court. And so you see these situations. You see these situations where people do feel a sense of shame. And so if you tell them, you won't go to hell, or you will go to hell, oftentimes that can be encouragement for people who feel like they deserve to go to hell. And the reality is that we all deserve to go to hell, but there's a God who shows grace. There's a God who shows forgiveness. There's a God who wants something better for us than that. And so we need to make sure that we pursue them, but pursue them wisely. So if you see something, say something. Make sure that you ask the extra question. Make sure you look for the warning signs. The L in the next page in plan is this, to listen. Okay? More than anything you can do to help a struggling person with suicidal thoughts is take the time to listen to their story and pay attention to their disappointments with a caring ear. And I can't tell you how important it is that you don't try to fix all the issues with somebody who's suicidal. You don't need to try to fix all their sin issues, particularly in the beginning when they're at a point of instability. You need to choose to listen. You need to choose to speak words of hope. But you don't have to you don't have to go into heavy coaching mode about all the struggles and all the disappointments they face. You can't deal with all the disappointments when they're in an issue, when they're in despair, and when they're at a destructive point. You got to deal with that issue directly, because once they desire to live, they're willing to deal with those other issues. But whether or not you know how to guide them to overcome their disappointments, to be listened to is to feel loved, help them to understand how the gospel addresses the deepest longings of their heart, and assure them that God's word does give guidance to address their disappointment and their ability to find hope. So again, listening for some of the warning signs. What are we listening for? Talk of suicide in general. Specific verbal statements such as, I wish I'd never been born. Oftentimes my boys are adopted, and oftentimes when you're dealing, with kids who have been adopted and they're dealing with the complications of that, you may hear those kind of statements. I wish I'd never been born. I wish I never would have been, put into your family. And kids who are adopted oftentimes struggle with depression and partly because of the trauma and the other circumstances they've gone through. Same with kids in the foster care system and other places. As well, they are dealing with, a different set of complications than kids who are biological children. Yet it's beautiful when God is able to come through and meet them in their point of need. A preoccupation with death, terminal illness, graveyards, wills, burial plots. You have people who are just fascinated with death. Particularly, you might see that with young people. You might see that with, just in the way that they dress and the way that the music, movies, and other things, you see their fascination with death. It's dark, and it can be a warning sign. Giving away valuable possessions, people who start giving away cars and pets and other things. Again, they're planning for the future without them around. And planning for the care of dependents, changes in eating, sleeping, or grooming habits. All of a sudden, they don't care what their appearance is. They're not leaving the house. They're not sleeping very well. A sudden state of euphoria following a long depression. It's kind of a calm before the storm. When people decide finally that they're going to take their life, they don't immediately go do it. But their whole attitude typically changes. You see almost a sense of relief. And then once they finally decided that this is going to be the path forward, when they begin to put the plan into action. You may see, when if you're working with a person that you know has some suicidal temptations, you may see that you, if you see a calm before a storm, you need to be specifically intentional about asking, is there a plan in place? Because oftentimes you'll find that there is. Withdrawing from others or favorite activities and a lack of fear of death, taking risks. Again, you see risk-taking behavior. I alluded to that earlier with somebody driving 100 miles per hour and, you know, on city streets, you know, not stopping at stoplights and these kind of things. This is where they kind of how they move forward. So the A in a plan is action plan. And so this is where we're going to be taking some action. And the first thing you're doing when you find out about a suicidal person is you're assessing the risk. You know, when working with a suicidal person, you can help them assess the risks in their life and take steps to avoid them. And you're going to be getting a safety checklist that many professional counselors use to assess the risk level. And that's also available on our website at biblicalcounselingcenter.org. We're going to be making that available through the Alliance as well. But it's good to kind of work through a safety checklist and just ask, what is the risk level here? The second thing you need to do is you need to ask for a promise. Informal counseling in particular, no harm contracts can be helpful tools, but a sample contracts, again, provide in our resource center, and we'll make sure we get that out to you as well. But help them develop a specific plan to do of what to do if they feel overwhelmed. So particularly those who live alone, it's really important that they have a plan in place to reach out to someone. I remember getting a phone call last year and from one of our counselors at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night. And it's from one of her counselees, and she had gotten a text, and it certainly had alerted her to the fact that one of her counselees might be feeling suicidal thoughts. And so we tried to get some more information, but we found out that the young woman lived alone and that there was no family close by, and that she had a previous suicide attempt. And so we had to make a decision. We were an hour away from where this person was, so it wasn't something where we could quickly go knock on the door and check, and there was no real strong connection with her church. And so we asked the police department to go and do a wellness check. So they went and knocked on her door and kind of assessed the question of, is she truly suicidal? Now, you might think that people might get annoyed with you or upset with you if you do that, but I found it's actually the opposite. That actually helps you to develop a relationship with them because they know that you care. And don't feel at all bad about calling 911 to have them come and check and see if someone's suicidal. They're good at that. The police and fire department is trained in asking those kind of questions and kind of determining where they're at. And they will often take people into the emergency room to get them checked out. It's so much better to do that than to find out the next day that, there was more than despair. There was suicidal intent and they followed through. So ask for a promise. If you can do that over the phone, you can do that in person. If you're in counseling, there's a sample contract, but it's asking them for the next opportunity to meet with them, asking them to say that they're willing to reach out if they get to a suicidal point. Agree to a check-in plan. Daily check-ins are needed to ensure that they will have somebody to talk with. In a church-based situation, in the counseling center situation, you need to make sure that they have somebody that are going to be checking in with every single day if they're actively suicidal. And make sure that they have a check-in plan. And a suicidal person lacks the motivation to seek helpful accountability, so they won't do that themselves. So somebody's going to have to be checking in with them. And so it's a burden that the church is going to have to take upon themselves. You as a counselor, if you're only working with a few people, you might be able to do that. It can be done via text for those who are younger. It can be done, via phone call for those who are older. But ask them how they're doing. How are their thoughts today? And offer the option to talk things through. arrange for further help. And one of the things that you have to understand is when dealing with a suicidal person, you're part of a team. Biblical counselor is part of a team, but oftentimes they're going to be dealing with a doctor. They're going to be dealing with, social service agencies or other places where they're going to be getting help to deal with some of the risk factors that accompany, suicidal thinking. But if they're not under the care of a doctor or counselor, connect them and offer to go with them. Reach out to a pastor who can follow up with them. Help them talk with their family. If their family can be a source of strength, it's always complicated to deal with family in suicidal situations because oftentimes, families are quite dysfunctional and their families are dealing with, a lot of stress, and their families cause greater stress within their life. And so sometimes families can be a tremendous asset. Sometimes families can be a tremendous risk factor. And so you got to be discerning there. But if they're not connected with the church, pick them up. A recent study found that suicide risk decreases 400% for those who attend church just once a month. Get that? 400% decrease in suicide rates when people attend church just once a month. And so if they had just one friend who was willing to once a month take them to church, just that fact saves lives. And so, again, it's a call to say, our churches need to be better about engaging the whole issue of suicide. We need to be better about reaching out to those who are hurting and making sure that we help them get further help. And as biblical counselors, we need to be on the front lines of that. We need to be making sure that people are finding sources of strength and encouragement and accountability within the church. The last one is just accountability to follow through. Once the immediate crisis seems over, it's easy to move on. But suicidal thoughts tend to be cyclical, and the pattern of thinking aren't easily changed. And so you need to hold them accountable to follow through with some of the things that you've challenged them to do. And so stop living according to the feelings and ultimately start to live according to the principles. Take some baby steps to address some of the issues. If financial stressors are what's leading them to a point of despair, then how can we help them to both seek assistance in financial ways, and then also to seek employment in ways that are realistic. I think of multiple situations where I've had people at a point of despair because the reality is they should be on disability because they probably were unable to work. And yet, if you know anything about the disability process, you realize that you don't make it through the disability process without a loving friend who's willing to help you through it. And you need an advocate. You need some people who are going to walk alongside you. The person who is mentally disabled to the point where they should be on disability oftentimes can't make it through that process themselves. They end up not getting the resources that they need in order to function. So they get to this point of despair. And so there needs to be an accountability to follow through with what they're called to do. If their family is their stressor, then how do we help them resolve and work through conflict? If substance abuse is what leads them to a difficult spot, then how can we help them with addictions and getting a handle on the substance issues, whether it's going to a rehab center or whether it's getting part of a recovery group and counseling? How can we help people who are struggling with substance abuse who can often get to a suicidal point of despair? They're running from their issues and they're running to substances. And so we have to stop them from running to substances, but then we also have to stop them from running from their issues or else they just transfer their addiction to something else. And so, again, when you look at the risk factors, part of the ongoing conversations with those who are dealing with suicidal struggles is to start to say, okay, what are the stressors that lead them to the point of being in despair? And how can we actively as a church begin to address those struggles and help, help them to, help them to make progress so that they're not stuck in this point of despair where they feel like there's no path forward. They feel like, the destructive choice might be the best path forward. So, flip the page there to next steps. Okay. The end for plan is just next steps. Beyond, once you get people out of the crisis, now what are some of the next steps that you can take? And so suicidal thoughts and desires need to be examined in light of who God is and his purposes for us in this life. And so We're not simply content to see this with creating better functioning rebels who no longer deal with suicidal thoughts. We want people to have the joy of the Lord. We want people to replace suicidal thoughts with healthy thinking that ultimately loves the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, and mind, and loves their neighbor themselves. And so it is loving mercy to engage a person who's suicidal and help them to save their life, regardless of whether you're able to have a spiritual conversation with them or not. So don't try to have spiritual conversations with people, who are on the edge of the building. Try to get them off the edge of the building. But ultimately, if God brings them into your life and you're able to have the spiritual conversations with them, we need to make sure that we are helping them to see a life from, God's point of view. And so how do we have some of the next step, spiritual conversations, and what are some of those? And so flip down to kind of the bullet points here. But the first thing is this. Do not try to manipulate those who have suicidal thoughts through shame. Looking for long-term solutions. You look for long-term solutions, not just temporary ones. They're already dealing with a lot of shame. They're dealing with shame because of the despair and the issues that the destructive choices that they're tempted to make. And don't manipulate them. Don't shame them into better behavior. Help them to look for long-term solutions. Be clear to determine if they actually are saved. Provide hope through evangelism if they don't know the Lord and forgiveness of sins. Guys, what a beautiful thing it is to wrestle with those who are suicidal and go, part of why you lack hope is that you don't see the hope that God provides. You don't see the good news of the gospel. And that's so crucial. And sometimes you might be able to have that conversation with somebody on the edge of the building. Sometimes you might just need to, grab by the collar and pull them back in the building. God knows and can give you wisdom there. Okay. Schedule twice weekly face-to-face visits until they've stabilized and daily check-in. So a phone call, every day of some sort. And then, you ought to try to meet with them twice a week. With somebody who has kind of suicidal thoughts and temptations. Offer that you're available to meet more often than that, or somebody within the church is able to meet more often than that. But, they're going to need something more than once a week visits in order to be able to reorient their thinking back towards a point of hope from despair. And over time, you're going to examine the idols of the heart that have led to the unmanageable disappointments, resulting in depression and hopelessness. And so, again, you're helping them to see, why has life been so disappointing for you? Why has it been so difficult? And help them to isolate their perceived unmet needs. Life without what is not worth living because why? And counsel that issue from God's perspective. And then lead the person through a practical plan of action to solve what seems to be unsolvable, introducing new solutions to the problem. And so, again, this is where you're going to get your sanctified common sense on. And you're just going to try to begin to come up with different solutions. I know, today as I'm counseling, I'm dealing with, issues of anger, and I'm dealing with issues of substance abuse, and I'm dealing with marriage conflict, and all three issues can easily lead somebody unchecked down to a point of despair and destructive behaviors. And so, yet, reality is that in all the cases that I dealt with today in counseling, there's different perspectives, and there's some practical solutions, and you stepping outside of their situation, stepping outside of their family, you can get them an outsider's perspective. And so lead them through some practical plan of action. We are not going to be just theological. We're not just going to be giving theological positions and theological treatises to those who are depressed. We're also going to be engaging in just the question of how do I pay my bills, and how do I get the food that I need, and how can I relate better to my wife who seems to drive me crazy all the time. These are the questions that people are asking in the midst of despair when they're looking for an escape. So uncover and help replace non-biblical thought patterns through journaling, homework, find out what's blocking their problem solving. So next page, the last page here, determining destructive influences. you know, what are some of the influences they have, and, you know, counseling the rebellious nature of suicide intent, ultimately challenging that it's an issue of autonomy and God's authority. God bought you and purchased you with a price for those of you who are believers. And for those of you who aren't, God has a perfect plan for your life. So embrace that. Teaching suffering is part of God's plan to refine us, that you see in Job, and then seek to direct their focus from escape to contentment. The reality is, I found in most of the situations when you're dialoguing with those who are struggling with depression and suicidal thoughts, the reality is they're fantasizing about their way of escape. They want a way of escape out of the struggle that they're facing. And suicide seems to be, you know, perhaps the most logical way, or the safest way, or it seems to be the only permanent way out of the pain and struggle that they're facing. And so what are you going to do? You're going to provide ongoing encouragement and support through your church, and for them to finding ways for them to serve and to be served. They need a purpose greater than themselves. And so is there a place where people who have suicidal thoughts can serve at your church? That's kind of a tricky question for sure, right? But where do we plug people in whose thoughts are plaguing them, and who get stuck in this loop of negative thinking? How do we engage them in a wise way? And so provide ongoing encouragement, support. As much as anything, those who are suicidal benefit from the hope of Christian friendship, from the love of Christ being incarnated through your hands and through your feet, and through you engaging with them in loving and compassionate ways. Don't underestimate the power of compassion to save lives for those who are suicidal. As a counselor, be someone who's willing to listen and be compassionate, and put on the heart of Christ. And when you do that, you will encourage people who thought that suicide was the only way out, that there's hope, there's a different path forward. And, you know, God's going to use you in that. So that's all I have for right now. We're going to hop back on here for the Q&A here in a second. But thanks so much for, you know, hanging out with me tonight. And certainly, if you want any of our resources, you can go to biblicalcounselingcenter.org. We're going to be sending a bunch to you. And we love what they're doing at the Biblical Counseling Alliance and getting you guys quality resources. And we're happy to partner with that. So we're just grateful to be here. Thanks.